Kath McAloon's got a wrap of the news for this week. Morning, Kath.
Good morning, Edwina.
And it was a big, big, big week and endlessly evolving story in dairy world.
Another huge week for watchers of the dairy industry and particularly the country's largest processor, Murray Goulburn. So you remember at the end of last week, we had the news that the competition watchdog was taking Murray Goulburn to court over what it alleges is unconscionable conduct, saying that it misled suppliers on milk prices that they could expect before it slashed the prices last year. And then this week, the embattled dairy processor was in the news again when it announced that it would be closing three of its factories as it just battles with sort of ever-diminishing supplies of milk.
Line, yes, and some of these were quite a surprise, weren't they?
Yeah, well, there had been speculation for recent months that closures were imminent, especially after back in February the company posted a huge loss, a $31.9 million loss for the first 6 months of the financial year. But it wasn't these particular factories that were necessarily sort of being talked about. And 360 jobs is the big figure. So two factories will close in northern Victoria and one in northern Tasmania. So those local communities where those factories are really gutted by this news. And those are obviously, you know, big employers in small towns. So, so some really sad news for those communities this week. But there was some sort of positive news for farmer suppliers of Murray Goulburn this week, because the processor also announced that it would end its controversial milk supply support package. Now, what this is, it's effectively a system it had in place to claw back some of the money that was sort of paid to suppliers that they then had to repay to the company.
So this was the retrospective
exactly,
element.
Exactly, yeah. Yep. So it was announced last year as a way for farmers to repay what they owed when the company suddenly and retrospectively cut their prices. So Murray Goulburn now says that it won't keep doing that, and it will in fact refund money that it has taken from farmers in the past year. In relation to the factory closures, the company says that it was a decision that had to be made. Their CEO, Ari Mervis, says it was really just unviable to keep those factories open, even if they had have looked to, you know, reduce the schedule, you know, downgrade the amount that they were producing or have temporary shutdowns. So this is what he had to say.
We looked at it from many different angles and are very aware of the adverse consequences, not only on our employees, but equally on the communities in which they operate. And the decision, a very difficult one, but a necessary decision that was required, just given that those facilities happen to be the older facilities, the less scalable facilities.
Now, during the last year, Deputy Prime Minister and Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce has visited a lot of dairy communities across Victoria and other states affected. He has been very vocal about trying to do something about the milk crisis. What did he have to say to this latest announcement?
Well, he says the government will have a look and see if there is anything they can do to support those communities where the jobs have been lost. But he also took it as a bit of an advantage to have a bit of a kick at the cooperative's former managers. So in that court case that the ACCC announced last week, they singled out the former managing director, Gary Halu, and the former chief financial officer, Bradley Hingle. The ACCC alleges that they were knowingly concerned in giving farmers this misleading information on prices sort of ahead of the big price cuts. And if that is found to be the case by the federal court, they could cop huge fines, like really, really massive fines,
hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. And so Barnaby Joyce, the Agriculture Minister, he's sort of just putting the blame for this whole fiasco squarely at the feet of the cooperative's former managers who are now facing that federal court action. This is what he, Mr. Joyce, had to say.
What it puts up in big flashing lights is that the previous management of Murray Goulburn did some pretty ordinary things, and the ramifications of it have been widespread. But I'm happy that farmers are now getting more money. I'm happy, I think they're getting paid back some of the so-called loan money that they were repaying that they never knew they had a loan for.
Other class action, and there were several class actions that got underway, but one has been dropped.
Yeah, so we're starting to get a bit of a resolution, I guess, almost 12 months on from this whole saga. One of the law firms that was bringing a class action, and that class action was for $200 million against Murray Goulburn for those retrospective clawback of prices. They've now decided to drop it this week because the company announced that it will forgive that debt and it will pay back some of the funds that it's raised. So the principal at Adley Bernsteiner Lawyers, David Bernsteiner, says the case will be dropped against Murray Goulburn, but he says a similar case that they were bringing against rival company Fonterra still stands.
One of the things Fonterra says is that we paid those high prices because we had to match Murray Goulburn. There are problems with that answer legally, but that is one of the things that Fonterra says. Now that Murray Goulburn has in effect wound back those financial dynamics, it'll be interesting to see if Fonterra does the right thing. If they don't, we will proceed with the class action.
And a bit of a language warning for this next story, if you happen to have small ears listening or bad language is offensive for you, but it does demonstrate just how strongly some of these communities are feeling after this week's announcements of factory closures.
Yeah, the response from communities, as we said earlier, that they're really gutted. But one Victorian dairy farmer in particular had a very strong message, a very blunt message to Murray Goulburn. He actually ploughed this message into a 10-acre paddock. So we've seen photos of this taken from the sky. It's quite on a huge scale. So the farmer, Tim Prime, used his plough to carve out the letters F-U-C-K-M-G into the paddock after that announcement from the company that it was closing the local Kiwa factory in northeast Victoria. Now, the farmer, Tim Prime, says that he wanted to do this basically to cheer up another dairy farming maiden, to send a bit of a message when that news came through.
It was reasonably big. It took me about 15 minutes to do or something, but I had to stop when I got to the Murray Goulburn logo. I had to look up on the internet to make sure I got that right. But, yeah, it turned out pretty well in the end.
But it was a short-lived message because he had to get on with it and plant an oat crop, so it didn't stay
always
for long.
Always the practical.
Yes.
These farmers, always practical. Now, there's been a lot of kind of what are we doing with Hempas Food. Some decisions were made by state and federal ministers.
Yeah, this could open up a bit of a new industry for farmers. They're getting rather excited because late last week a meeting of Australian and New Zealand authorities got together and they decided that low THC hemp seeds are fit for human consumption. So you could be seeing, I guess, things like hemp smoothies or hemp seed brownies on cafe menus before the end of the year. And farmers in the industry are readying themselves to sort of capitalise on these changes to the hemp laws. Now, just to clarify, that low THC means that consumers won't get high if they eat the hemp seed. So it's sort of a different chemical makeup to sort of, your marijuana.
No hash cookies coming to the shelves.
No
hash cookies,
yes. No. Right? But farmers have been sort of really eagerly awaiting this. Some people have been getting around the laws by selling hemp seed products sort of, that are intended to be eaten, but they're selling them as beauty products or other products. But now it will be 100% legal, and there's much excitement from, some industry and farmers who see it as a bit of an opportunity. Andrew Carvasilis is from Nimbin in northern New South Wales. He's been breeding hemp seed varieties specifically for the Australian climate, and he says that this 6-month wait now before the change comes into effect will give him just the right amount of time to get winter crops in and ensure that he's got a lot of Australian grown hemp seeds available.
Because this is seed hemp that we're growing, we're not after the big tall varieties that people associate with fibre. We've developed short varieties that are easy to handle by the infrastructure that we already have in place.
And down in Victoria, a company is building a processing facility in Geelong. The company is Australian Primary Hemp, and their sales director, Sky Patterson, hopes that it will become the hub for hemp processing in Australia.
But it opens the gate for a global booming industry, and it allows us to, really push our products into the world, and we're sort of opens the gates for the farmers are in the region to grow hemp seeds.
We will have to wait until the end of this year to find out the new national standards for animal welfare around free-range egg production, but there was some news on the labelling of free-range products.
Yeah, this has got people sort of had, various reactions from farmers. The federal government's made a ruling on free-range egg standards, and it's already drawing criticism from some egg farmers and also from the consumer group Choice. So under this new national standard, any eggs that are labelled as free-range will require a stocking density outdoors of 10,000 hens or less per hectare. But some free-range egg farmers, like New South Wales producer Mark Killen, think that that's way too many hens in a small space. Mr. Killen says he describes the decision as rubbish.
Well, Well, the density is just a number they've plucked out of the air. It's not really a meaningful number of anything. There's 10,000 square metres in a hectare, so if chooks were prone to spread out to utilise an area that was given to them, that would be one chook per square metre. If you leave a chook in a square metre for a day, all you've got is bare ground. So that's not an environmentally sound practice.
And it's not something that consumer group choice is particularly happy about either. More have watched this space, I think, when the welfare standards come out later on. Now, an extraordinary week for Wagyu beef.
Yeah, Australia is really establishing itself as sort of the international hub for Wagyu beef. That's that sort of really expensive beef with the marbled fat that originates from Japan. But outside of Japan, Australia is sort of one of the industry leaders in this sector. And it was really evident this week when the Australian Wagyu Association held its annual conference, and there were some sales alongside of that. And the prices paid for the breeding stock just really far and away exceeded any previous records. So the top price for a bull was $105,000. Now compare that to the average price for the last 12 months, which was around $10,000.
Wow.
It's just massive. A yet-to-be-born heifer sold for $95,000. And then there was a lot of 10 semen straws that come from a top bull, and they sold for $28,000 per straw. Some
that
of those
is
were
extraordinary.
It's huge, the figures. So $280,000 all up for all 10. Some of them were snapped up by overseas buyers, and the association says that it really is a sign that Australia is becoming a central hub of Wagyu genetics. Association President Peter Gilmore says it really does reflect the standing of Australian Wagyu internationally.
I think it shows tremendous respect for the Australian Wagyu industry as the foremost industry, I guess, in the world outside of Japan, where genetics can no longer come from.
And finally, what is the world's best steak?
Well, an Australian producer has taken out the last two titles for the world's best steak, and now they're going for their third consecutive title. So this is Jack's Creek, which is on the Liverpool Plains, and it in fact is a Wagyu farm, speaking of Wagyu. And so the last 2 years they've won the title of the world's best steak at competitions in London. They'll be entering again this year, and to sort of help them out, the Jack's Creek, as well as their German distributor, have bought out some of Germany's top restaurant owners and chefs to help them choose which cuts they should enter in the competition this year when it's held in London in July. Beef breeder David Warmoll says they're giving it everything they've got to get this third consecutive title.
We're hoping to do a warning and get a hat trick, but you have to be a realist. We are competing against 17 or 18 other countries all over the world, you know, 10, 15 different breeds of cattle. Here's hoping. And we'll be doing our best for Australia.
Warnie's not doing too bad though, is he?
No, even with the facelift.
That's gold. I hope they get to eat some of the steak.
Yeah, indeed.
Yes. Thank you, Kat.
Thanks, Edwina.
If you'd like to read more about any of those stories, head to the RN homepage and find A Country Breakfast under the Programs tab.